Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Regular readers of the Post-Dispatch have been reading in recent weeks about the 1138th Missouri National Guard Engineering Company now serving in Afghanistan. Most of the nearly 100 1138th members are from this area. The reports have been the work of reporter Jesse Bogan and photographer J.B. Forbes. They were embedded with the 1138th. Bogan's a veteran who has been in that part of the world before, covering the war in Iraq. Forbes, chief photographer for the Post, has also covered the war in Iraq and covered stories from some 30 countries. They have seen a lot and have enabled us to see it, too, through words and pictures. The 1138th has a difficult mission to clear those deadly improvised explosive devices, IEDs, that have taken so many lives and maimed so many Americans. I'm happy to welcome home Messrs. Bogan and Forbes and welcome them to our Grand Center studio to talk about their time in Afghanistan. And by the way, you can see their work at stltoday.com/Afghanistan. We have a link at stlpublicradio.org where we also have some supplemental info and pictures. Gentlemen, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks. Glad to be here.
Jesse, let me begin with you. What stands out about this assignment?
Just the opportunity to put a local face on an international conflict. It's an 11-year war. It's the longest in our country's history. About $600 billion has been spent on combat. And nobody's really talking about it. It didn't seem to come up much during the elections. And so it was pretty gratifying to be able to go there and work on this story with JB and tell it for the Post-Dispatch for readers in Missouri and in Illinois.
JB, what about you? What stands out?
Well, reiterate what Jesse was saying, I actually first became interested in this or got the idea that I really wanted to go to Afghanistan by listening to NPR. And there was a show on in November where the spokesperson said the two main candidates did not talk about the war at all and didn't bring it up. And I thought, what a crime. And we should be talking about it. And we do need to bring up the whole issue once again and bring it to the attention of St. Louis and our readers.
It's almost been treated as if that war is over and we're closing in on an end date, if you will, but it's certainly not over.
No, it's not. Yeah. Got a long ways to go yet. They are backing down. They are pulling people out, but it's a long, slow process.
Jesse, the folks that you were working with over there in the 1138, they're coming home relatively soon, aren't they?
They're supposed to come home this spring. Yeah. So the drawdown won't affect them so much as their deployment being cut shorter. If anything, it's making their life busier. There's bases to close. There's people to move. There's supply routes to keep open. So they're not talking much about the drawdown.
They are getting short, as they say in the military, right, if they're coming back in a couple
right.
of months. What is morale like over there, given what we've just talked about with JB, with the fact that people aren't talking much about Afghanistan? Do they know that?
I thought that would come up more in the reporting. Mm-hmm. And for those guys, and I say guys, they're all men in this company, they're more focused on the task at hand, the today's mission, the equipment that needs to be fixed today, the route that they have to run the next day. They're not talking about these broader debates. And I thought it would come up more. And one of the lieutenants who I actually grew up with down in Rolla, Missouri, I was talking to him about it. And he said, you know, we may not be talking about it or people may not be talking about it at home, but they're paying for it in their taxes.
Well, that is for sure. $600 billion is not small change or chump change, is it? Mm-hmm. What was your sense of morale, JV?
I heard it the most from the oldest member of the unit, a guy named Pappy Stevenson. He lives out in West County. A very interesting, very energetic soldier. And he told me that morale picked up greatly every time they go to the mailbox and they've got more things coming in from people from St. Louis, from Missouri, from all over the country, and people who do care and who are thinking of them. And he says that really brings up their whole spirit.
You know, that takes me back to every war movie that I've ever seen. Mail call was the most important time of the day, and the reading of the letters and that sort of thing was terrifically important.
They need forklifts to carry all the mail that's coming in. I mean, there's, I would say that they actually have more than they probably need on care packages, but they like getting them. I mean, they get lots of rosary beads and and you know, all kinds of things, from toiletries to candy, more than they'll be able to eat. But that does seem to just make them happy to get that kind of stuff.
This is a different time, and has been for a few years now, with regard to communications, with email being so prominent. And Skype now is part of the picture. Were you finding a lot of use of this technology? Go ahead, Jamie.
Most definitely. And we followed one soldier in particular. First, we went to his wife's house down in South St. Louis and visited with her. And then a few weeks later, here we are on the opposite side, sitting with him in his little compartment and talking with her on a daily basis. And that makes a huge difference for all of these soldiers, as it did for us, because we were – I was on Skype almost daily with my wife, and I believe Jesse was too, so, with his girlfriend. And so it helped us. And we were also on there with our bosses, who were –
oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, we were just a phone call away.
I guess that's important. I mean, maintaining communications is so much different. You guys have been around for a while. So much different than it was at one time now, because it's instant. Jesse?
It's kind of an odd dance, though, too, because it is such a modern war. These guys, I mean, they check in with their families before they go out on a multi-day mission. And so if the mission's delayed, which they usually are, you know, families back home are worried, you know, why haven't we heard from my husband? They're watching life's events unfold back home, too, from over there. They'll just leave the Skype on, and they may not be talking, but they'll just have it on. And so a baby might crawl by the screen. Or in one case, a guy watched his newborn daughter be born. Guy from St. Genevieve, Missouri. He hasn't met her yet, but he saw her born on Skype.
Yeah, it's hard for most of us to imagine living that way and being apart, and yet trying so desperately to maintain that contact.
A telling detail about that is he named his daughter Kimber, which is a firearms manufacturer.
Oh, wow.
So while they're making these sacrifices, some of these guys really do love what they're doing. They like to blow stuff up. They get really excited when they find IEDs, we're told. So.
Yeah. And it's very touching, having read your pieces. The guys wearing cardinal caps, we read about that. And was it Outpost Frontenac was the name of where they were? They really try very, very hard to maintain that association with home.
And the Frontenac came from – it was a Canadian base. So the Plaza Frontenac didn't pay for that advertising from here. They're just benefiting from it. Yeah. It came from the Canadians that were there before.
Let's talk a little bit about the mission. You talk about going out on the road, and I guess their mission was pretty much exclusively clearing IEDs. Is that right?
That's it.
Tell us about I'll start with you, Jesse. Tell us about a typical day in that line of work.
Well, it takes some very heavy machinery, the American way they do it. The Afghans do it a slightly different way. There's on a typical convoy, I mean, imagine $15 million worth of equipment. That includes wreckers, mechanics, ground penetrating radar, this massive, what we call a battleship on wheels, called a Buffalo, which even has a V-shaped hole to kind of repel the blast, that drives up and extends a long mechanical arm and scrapes in the dirt where they think a bomb is. And, you know, there's video cameras, there's all kinds of guns, weapons. And so they're going out there, and they're creeping along these usually dirt roads at a very slow pace, you know, like 2 kilometers an hour. The slower they went, the more accurate they seemed to be at finding them. So it can be very tedious, very boring, and people want to get back to the base. You know, they're hungry, they're uncomfortable, they're very cramped vehicles to be in. But it takes patience. It's, as the lieutenant kept saying to his men, it's a game of inches. And the success rate, I mean, if you're doing it well, is about 70%. I mean, if you have great equipment and you're being observant, then you find 70% of the bombs. The other ones you get hit by.
Mm-hmm. Did they suffer, have they suffered in the months that they've been there, any kind of losses as a result of this dangerous work?
No. Yeah. No losses, but they have run into IEDs, ones they did not find. And in talking with one of the soldiers he talked about it almost matter-of-factly, that in January his vehicle veered just a little bit further out of the path of the next vehicle, and that was just enough to hit the pressure plate and have this IED go off underneath his vehicle. And it was to have him talk about it so calmly and say that the very first thing that happened was that it raised the whole vehicle off the ground, and everybody there hit their heads, their helmets on the ceiling, and then the vehicle filled up with dust. And he said the first thing he did was reach down and check to make sure that his legs were still there. And he said once he saw that his legs were there, his hands were there, he thought everything would be okay.
Mm-hmm. That's another thing which is hard for the rest of us to imagine that. And so many young men and women have come back maimed from exactly this kind of work, and also just having been struck by one of these explosive devices while they weren't looking for them. Mm-hmm. Did they have any sense? Do they have any sense that something might be there as a result of other means? I know the dogs are in use. Do they go out just looking for them, or do they have some sense as to where they might be?
Some of them, they have information about where the IEDs are. There's all kinds of things going on in a war zone with different planes or surveillance balloons. And so there are some out there where they have the coordinates on, but by and large, they don't know. And the risk that is involved is pretty incredible. The unit that they replaced was an Indiana Guard unit, and they lost 6 of their 100 guys. And so you can really spook yourself out thinking about this mission a lot. And but once you get over there and you ride with these guys, and we were fortunate enough to ride further in the back, it's usually the trucks in the front that get hit. You see that, you know, they're working hard. They may joke around to kind of deal with the stress, but they're very focused in what they're doing, and they realize they can hit a bomb at any moment.
I have to take a break. We'll do that now and come back and continue our conversation. With me is Jesse Bogan, a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and J.B. Forbes, who is the chief photographer for that newspaper, just back from Afghanistan. We're talking about the time they spent embedded with the 1138th Engineering Company. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment, and if you have questions or comments for these two gentlemen, you can always give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We will take a tweet at STL on air, and we are also reachable through Facebook. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation with J.B. Forbes, chief photographer for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and Jesse Bogan, reporter for that newspaper. They are just back from Afghanistan, where they were embedded with the 1138th Engineer Company in southern Kandahar province, right? That's exactly where we're talking about the difficulty of the assignment that members of this company had, J.B. They're trained for that sort of thing. You guys are not. Even though you're at the back of the line when they're going out on assignment, tell us what kind of feelings you were experiencing.
Well, I was certainly apprehensive, especially on the first mission when I didn't know what to expect, didn't know what we were going to go through, and the fact that I'm going to be wearing this heavy body armor and a helmet. And I sat in on the briefing when the lieutenant talked to the platoon beforehand, and not only does he go through each and every mission, he goes through what exactly they're going to do. He makes reminders to them about the what ifs, the different variables that can come up, the dangers that are involved, and then at the end of it, he goes through a safety briefing every single time and keeps talking to them about safety. That we're nearing. We're heading down that final road to our mission, our time here in Afghanistan, and he wants everybody to come home and everybody to come home safe. So for me, it was interesting because after all this talk about safety and I go through that first mission and we all come back and we're all I was certainly feeling relieved, and then I climbed down out of the buffalo and I promptly cut my hand on the ladder and I think. Wait a minute. I'm the only person to get injured on this whole trip.
What about your apprehension, Jesse?
The worst part of the trip for me was getting ready to go and telling people you're going over to Afghanistan. And most people, you know, they've heard about blasts and bombs and people coming home maimed. So it's hard not to fall into that groove just thinking about all the dangers. And we definitely assessed the dangers, but that was the worst part. Once we got there, we had a heck of a lot of work to do. You know, we don't go that far over there and not come back with some stories. And so we were focusing on our work. And I'm a tall guy, and being in some of that machinery that long and having the weight of the armor, that is extremely uncomfortable. And some of these guys, they go out on these missions. Sometimes they go for days, and they'll sleep in their trucks. And so it's a very uncomfortable spot to be doing your job.
Well, what is the weight of the armor you had to carry with you?
Oh, what would you say, JB? 30 pounds, maybe.
Probably.
Maybe doesn't seem like much, but you feel it on your body after wearing it.
After a period of
time,
the
helmet,
certainly.
Too, the Kevlar helmet, and you got earphones on like we have now, and you try to have eye protection on, and those fog up, and it's just not being a seasoned soldier. There's little things that you need to kink out, you know, work out.
You looked like you wanted to say something, JV.
Well, when we thought about this assignment, I didn't hesitate when it came up, and when I found out that Jesse was had this in mind, and there was a potential to go over there. But it's all that afterwards stuff, and I was offered several times by my photo editor, Lyndon Steele. He said, "You can still change your mind, and there's no harm in that. You can get out of this." And there was never any question. I wanted to go, but then it comes up with you have to make sure that your will is in order, and that we have life insurance. And for me, writing a final letter home to my family as a just in case I don't come back. All those serious things that. That you don't normally have to do if I go on assignment here in St. Louis.
Sure. You're laughing about it, Jesse, but you're getting married in a month or two, as I understand
right.
it.
In a month.
Sure she loved the notion of you're going to Afghanistan.
Yeah, I updated. You know, I did do a will, and so that makes me laugh a little bit now. But so, yeah, just kind of that paperwork you need to take care of beforehand. That's the stuff that's not much fun.
How did the troops react to you guys?
I think they really opened it up to JB really well. I say this with total respect. You're a veteran. You're an older guy. Let me say this on here. He has rugged good looks. Oh. gray beard, gray hair. He's been all over the place. And JB lives on a small horse farm. He has grandchildren. He's from, again, total respect. Specs here. You're from a little bit of a different era than some of these guys. Some of them were in their 50s. JB, you're 63 years old. You've seen all kinds of things in the world, and I think the soldiers really liked having him around.
I remember him when he was just a young, good-looking guy before he got all this rugged stuff going for him. Yeah. How about you, JB, in terms of...
One of the nicest things that I remember was a couple of soldiers came up just on our last day or day before we were leaving. They knew we were going, and they said, even though we have been with them only a short time, we went out on mission with them, we've lived with them, we were now part of their group. And I really liked hearing that from them.
Do they worry about their Afghan colleagues? You know, we're reading so much about some of these people that we're training, turning on our guys and in many cases now, shoot and kill them. Mm-hmm. They talk about that? Do they worry about it?
At first, they thought that it was like, what are we getting into here? The base that they're at Forward Operating Base Frontenac, it had some so-called green-on-blue attacks. It was actually an Afghan security contractor that shot some soldiers there on base and killed a couple of them a couple years ago. And then there are Afghan troops there that are staying on a separate portion of the base. And when they first got there, there was a sense of preoccupation. But as time has gone on and nothing's happened in the 5 or 6 months that they've been there on their base, they've grown more comfortable with it. But they still drill for insider attacks and things like that.
Of course, that could be a danger point, JB, relaxing a little bit, thinking nothing has happened. That's precisely the time when it can happen, I guess.
Well, actually, I've got a story to go along with that because Jesse and I were invited to go down to the next forward operating base with the lieutenant colonel of our base. And he said there was going to be a graduation ceremony of some of the locals into the local security force there. So we traveled down there. We went through the gate. We got onto the Afghan side. And then I just started mingling with the Afghans, the locals, and taking pictures and sort of working my way up to getting closer and letting them get used to my camera. And all of a sudden, one of them came up to me and started poking me right on my my press pass and saying something. I had no idea what he was talking about or what he meant, and he kept gesturing, and he seemed to be getting more and more frustrated. And all of a sudden, from out inside his robes, he pulled out a pistol, and he started pointing at it and tapping it and gesturing. And I still didn't understand, so then he took the pistol and started tapping my press pass with it. And I don't have any pictures of that because I was much too focused on that gun and where his trigger finger was. But he didn't seem to be upset with me. And then afterwards, the interpreter said, "Oh, that was nothing. They all of them do that. They just gesture with their weapons." I said, "Well, then maybe all of them do it, but I certainly wasn't used to it."
Oh, wow. I can't imagine going through something like that. I have a lot of questions, but we have some people who want to get into this discussion, so let's bring them in right now. We'll start with Wendy calling from Jefferson County. Wendy, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm a coordinator for Jefferson County Military Family Support Network, and I just wanted to compliment you, Min, for doing such a wonderful job covering this story and including so many local men who are deployed. I know it meant a lot to their families, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have you been hearing from families? You've been back a relatively short time now. Have you been hearing from them since you've come back?
Yeah, a few people have definitely contacted us. And I have to say, you know, once the story started coming out, we'd already been over there a couple of weeks or so. And a lot of the guys did like the stories, but it wasn't overwhelmingly accepted either. You know, you'd be surprised in the military. They're supervisors for everything, and everybody needs to be promoted. And so some things did come out in the stories that some people weren't happy about. By and large, they're positive stories, though.
Sure. Can you give me a for instance?
maybe some of them said on one of the missions one time. You know, these guys are soldiers. They're not necessarily diplomats, and they've got a tough job to do. And it's telling the people that show up to do those kind of jobs aren't necessarily the ones that are the most politically correct. So, for instance, there was a soldier I was riding with, and he kept waving at the little children. And children are the same everywhere in the world, it seems like. And they run up to these convoys sometimes. And a lot of times they throw rocks, and a lot of times they don't wave back. And this soldier next to me, he has two daughters in the Girl Scouts. I mean, he loves kids. He's trying to get them to wave, and they won't wave back. And he says, you know, "Wave. I'm the one with the gun." Uh-huh. And you know, it's kind of a dark humor comment, and that stuff happens. And so I know that it seems like he might have gotten in trouble for that comment. I haven't seen that in print, but you know, that's an example.
JB, it's a little bit different with the camera.
Yes,
or is it?
It is different, but I was very pleased that our paper this past Sunday ran a page of portraits of soldiers. And for me, I was very glad that they did that, and they were all holding up their good luck charms, things that they have to have with them when they go out on mission. And it, for me, it personalized it that much more because they weren't necessarily in uniform. They didn't have their battle gear on, and they weren't soldiers. They were men. They were our neighbors, our sons, the people down the street. They're from West County. They're from Farmington. They're from all over, and they're volunteers. And while for the most part we have either forgotten or don't think about what's going on, here are men who are going over there and risking their lives. And I thought it was very important.
You know, one of the things that strikes me in talking about the National Guard units is these are guys who a couple of months prior were in offices or garages or wherever they were coming from. And then suddenly they find themselves in another part of the world at risk every day. That must take some serious adjusting to deal with that.
I love this kind of story. I mean, whether you approve of the war or not, I mean, having these regular folks being thrown into something pretty incredible and to see what they come up with and what they have to say and how they deal with it. I mean, I love working on a story like that. I mean, let me put a face to it. There was a guy named Specialist Jason Dane, and he's from the Ozarks. He's on his third deployment. He finds satisfaction in this job of looking for bombs. And he's not a gung-ho soldier. He reads a lot of Louis L'Amour. He's kind of quiet. He's not a lot. It's not a lot of hoorah going on with this guy. He says, man, just think about it. God knows how many people haven't been hit by these bombs that we find. And I forget if I said he's on his third deployment. Yeah. He's got kids at home down in Ellington, Missouri, and he doesn't have a job when he comes home. He wants to get a job in a mine in Reynolds County. So if anybody needs somebody, Specialist Jason Dane will be coming back to Reynolds County looking for a job.
And the same goes for me with the portraits I took of these guys with their lucky charms. And one of them, Sergeant Cratley, holds up a little booklet. And I said, what's that? And he said, it's the Constitution and Declaration of Independence. And I said, you carry that with you? He says, on every mission. I said, why? He said, because that's what I believe in. That's why I'm here.
Mm. Wow. Let's take another call and absorb what JB has just said. Brant is joining us from St. Louis. Go ahead, Brant. You're on the air.
Hi. I was in the Badakhshan region of Tajikistan this past summer at a music festival, which was right across the river from Afghanistan. And, in fact, is one of your alumni from UMSL that was the chief organizer of the festival called Roof of the World. It's an indigenous folk festival. And I met a lot of Americans and Westerners who were going over to Afghanistan to study languages and Afghan music and whatnot. And they didn't have any problem. So I got a visa. I ended up not going because they closed the border every day at 3:30. And so I kind of chickened out. But granted, there was something that happened in that town. It's called Khorog. Something did happen in that town a few days after I left. But I think the north of Afghanistan is a lot safer than the south. And I'm wondering if you could address that.
Jesse?
Yeah. Southern Afghanistan seems to be one of the riskier spots. It's close to the Pakistan border. It's where there's some Taliban safe havens or insurgencies, and they tend to live out in the boonies. It's also a Pashtun society, and they would like the coalition forces to leave. And so any military convoy in southern Afghanistan is really at the risk of being a target because the local people would like them to leave. Afghanistan is a tribal country. You can divide it up into sections. In northern Afghanistan, putting this pretty simply, I'm no expert on it, but there's a big difference between northern Afghanistan and southern Afghanistan. One being that many folks in northern Afghanistan would like the coalition forces to stay there and finish the job and keep the Taliban at bay. And like I said, in the south, many would like them to leave.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on any of that, JB?
No, okay. Just agree with Jesse.
Let me take this in a somewhat different direction for the moment. Both of you gentlemen spend time in Iraq. What sort of differences, I'll start with you, JB, what sort of differences between that experience when we were full-fledged at it there and this most recent experience?
Well, I wasn't embedded with the military for the most part when I was there in 2004. I was there for 6 weeks. And reporter Phil O'Connor and I were concentrating on stories about Americans who were there in Iraq helping out in one way or another or just going there for whatever reason. And it was quite different from the military side where these guys are very confined to their base and have very little contact with the general populace. So We stayed in a hotel that was outside the green zone. We were told that several months after we left there, it was blown up. We traveled the roads. We covered ourselves like an Iraqi would so that we would blend in more. Mm-hmm. But it was a chance to be out there and to talk with people and find out their opinions about the war.
This was before it really evolved into a full-scale civil war, before all
yes.
of that.
Yes.
How about mm-hmm. you, Jesse?
The biggest difference for me is looking out the windows of these armored vehicles. You know, you get to spend little bits of time. Maybe you interact a little bit with locals, but for the most part, you're with the military. And looking out the window, Afghanistan is so much poorer than Iraq. I mean, it's everybody keeps saying it. It's like going back through a biblical movie set. I mean, we're talking water wells with buckets and strings and ropes, no electricity, particularly in southern Afghanistan where we were. No polio vaccines for some of these kids. So in Iraq, you still had there was a lot more advertising, those kind of things. It's weird to go into a society and not see hardly any advertising, nothing on along the roadways, except maybe a government-sponsored radio station that's probably paid for by us. So that was a big difference.
You were only there for a relatively short period of time. Mm-hmm. It's probably an unfair question, but very briefly, I'll start with you, Jesse. Are you optimistic that once we're out of there, that this isn't going to this will evolve into something better than it was before we got there?
I wish I could tell you. I mean, the people that I've interviewed, you hear different different perspectives. You know, some people are optimistic, some aren't. It's definitely a humanitarian problem there, as well as security. So. It's interesting to me. One statistic was that 97% of the Afghan economy is somehow affiliated or by military spending, outside military spending. So once we leave, there is going to be a huge vacuum. It's going to be less money being spent. There are a lot of people getting paid by this. So we'll see. I don't know what to tell you on that.
Any thoughts on that, JV?
When we went on our final mission, we went up to a forward operating base next to a village called Darvishan. And I went into the village and there were men walking all around the village, and I had lunch in this hole-in-the-wall little restaurant. And after we left, the interpreter said that virtually everybody in there was either police or military. Now, they were all dressed like in normal Afghan dress, but virtually everyone in there was associated in one way or another, just as Jeff C. mentioned, that it is a military-run society, and that's where they – that's how they get their money.
And what are these people going to do when that money stops coming in is the big question, obviously. Have to take another break. We'll do that now. Our conversation is with Jesse Bogan and J.B. Forbes, both with the Post-Dispatch, both just back from Afghanistan, where they were embedded with the 1138th Engineer Company in southern Afghanistan. We'll continue our conversation and encourage more calls from you and the listening audience. We have lines open at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. If you like, send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air or reach us through Facebook. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with J.B. Forbes, chief photographer of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and with reporter Jesse Bogan. They are just back from Afghanistan. We're talking about that experience. And let me remind everyone that you can see their work through our website at stlpublicradio.org. We have a link to the material they filed when they were over there, and the material still keeps coming. You guys are still writing. And you can also find the work at stltoday.com/Afghanistan. Tell me something about how you guys work together. Two different approaches to what you're covering, or is it different? How do you coordinate? I'll start with you, Jesse.
Well, every photographer and reporter has a different kind of style, how they work in the field. I like images. I like writing stories that I see firsthand. So I kind of I'm looking for a lot of the same things that JV's looking for. So it's a difficult dance. I want to stay out of his frames. You know, that's photographers will throw a spear at you if you're not careful. JP didn't do that on this trip.
Are you joined at the hip when you're together, or do you go off independently and then somehow come back and put it together?
A little bit of both. We both had separate roommates, and so we worked together on a lot of stuff, but we were also in different vehicles on different missions. And we try to coordinate as best as we can and to make sure we're on the same page for the main stories.
But, what's your approach, David? What are you looking for?
I often thought that we should have had two-way radios with us just so that I could find him. Jesse kept very busy the entire trip, and he was constantly working. And I thought we communicated very well, and he would tell me what stories he was working on, and I'd try and make sure that I illustrated that story. And it was just a good experience. I've had some in the past that weren't as turned out quite as well with reporters who had a different style.
Do you in this digital age where you can look at the picture before it has to be developed someplace? Mm-hmm. Do you go through the photos together at some point and decide what to do with them?
I showed Jesse some of them and as we went along, and early on this mission, he had the opportunity to go out in the field just right outside our base to watch them do this explosion where they set off. It was a practice run to see how they set off IEDs. And so I stayed in the base because I had a view from the North Tower, and I set up my camera and did a video of it, and I was just stunned because the vehicles looked so small and the explosion was so large, and it seemed to encompass their vehicles. And I knew that he was sitting out there in one of those and just wondered what happened to him. So when he came back, I was more than happy to show him just what he had just lived through.
Really? And your response to that, Jesse?
I was inside the vehicles, and it's called a MCLIC charge, a mine clearing charge, and it is a massive explosion, but it's off at a safe enough distance, but it is pretty close. But as far as working together, too, it's really helpful being a team because there's all kinds of people to get to know and to learn what their story is. And so we could collaborate there. You know, did you hear about this guy, you know, Pappy, the plumber from St. Louis County? Well, what about Vika Singh, this Indian American who used to work on the riverboats or works on the riverboats when he's at home? So that was very helpful.
Who owns a horse farm?
Who owns a horse farm?
We won't hold that against him.
Yeah.
So. He actually said he's going to come visit me when he gets back.
Oh, really? On horseback, you think, or do we know yet? Speaking of animals, tell me about Lucy. That captured my attention in reading your dispatches.
Okay. We wanted to include Fort Leonard Wood in the coverage, and we were trying to set that up before we went. There's a mine dog named Lucy, a black lab, that's over in Afghanistan. And she goes and looks for mines and bombs and that kind of thing. And as a handler, too, Heath Garcia, who lives in Fort Leonard Wood. And they have seen all kinds of action. It's pretty amazing, their story. They've been in firefights. They've found bombs. And Lucy, this black lab, is trained to sit down when she finds some. This is all a big game to Lucy. And the handler is like, you know, don't sit down, don't sit. He knows her behavior enough that he doesn't want her to sit down in case she sets something off, because there can be mines in different places. So he said, you know, they have a couple more months to go in their deployment, but he thought Lucy has PTSD. But everything seemed to change when he'd toss her ball, which he would do during the firefights at times, too, to get her back on track.
Was he serious about PTSD?
It's hard to tell with some of these guys. I think he was smiling when he told the story, but he said whenever a gunshot would go off, her tail would go between her legs, and she would kind of whimper. And so he said that. You know, whether or not a dog has PTSD, I don't know. But
that's sort of what I do when a gunshot goes off, come to think of it.
But they certainly seen enough to, you know, to be concerned and scared by bombs. They'd been hit by three IEDs traveling with the Missouri Guard. So talk about bad luck, but good luck that they're still walking. And he said at the end of an interview, he's like, you know, I'd come back if Lucy would come back with me. You know, he's crazy about this dog.
And, of course, any animal is irresistible for a photographer.
That certainly helped, yes. Yeah. Actually, I have a black puppy that's just about like Lucy, so it reminded me of home.
About PTSD, now that that subject has come up, any evidence of that amongst the people you were working with? Do they talk about it? They're concerned about it? Any of them pulled back because of it?
Well, part of going over there that I like is that we have, you know, some skin in this game, and we've been over there. We've seen what some of them go through, or at least talk to them about it firsthand. And so I want to see how it plays out. Some of these guys have been hit multiple times by IEDs. They've been scanned for traumatic brain injury. They're constantly, you know, on some missions are bracing. They're like, please don't blow up, please don't blow up, please don't blow up, they say as they drive over certain stretches of road. You know, what impact that has on them, I don't know. I've done a pretty extensive story in recent months about a Marine from Lebanon, Illinois, who has PTSD. And, you know, it affects some soldiers and some it doesn't. You know, some people see all kinds of things and nothing happens. Some people see something small and it has a huge effect. Sure. But this is going to play out for a long time, the effects of this war, and the Post-Dispatch wants to follow it. And I hope people will follow it in our paper.
Any insight into any of that, JB?
Well, I wonder about the Specialist Hawkins, the guy that talked to me about making sure that his legs and hands were still there. Mm-hmm. And the fact that once it was determined that he was okay, they can't just stop and once the explosion goes off and go home, they have to continue on. And they continued on with their mission that day. They continued on to another mission the day after that. And he told me that he's thought about it and he's going to reenlist, even though he says he still has reoccurring headaches that bother him. But he thinks it's an important enough job that he's going to stick with it. And I think it's as much about his country as it is about his fellow soldiers. That the important thing for them is to not focus any further than that. They are there to protect their own, and they are all brethren and trying to make sure that everybody comes home.
What sort of facilities do they have in these forward operating bases for dealing with medical emergencies or dealing with somebody who has a mental issue?
Well, at our base, there's, as JB knows from cutting his finger, they can treat you for a lot of things, but it's near this mammoth base called Kandahar Airfield, which has about 30,000 people at it apparently and some pretty sporty hospitals. And so when some of the Missourians were hit, they spent some time at Kandahar Airfield where they were they had head scans and so on and so forth, where they had them do the equivalent of video games to see if they had, you know, the right function, or they just make their brains more active. So they're very close. You know, they usually don't do missions unless the weather's good, and so they can medevac people out by helicopters. And, you know, if it's really bad, they'll take them straight to these pretty good hospitals.
As I understand it from what I've read and heard, is that a lot of lives have been saved because of their ability to get people away from wherever it happened to someplace where it can be treated.
And it's when we sit through these briefings before the missions, one thing that stood out from the start is this guy who works for the DEA in St. Louis, actually, is McClarney. He's briefing them on tourniquets. And he just says, matter of fact, to these guys before they go out on the mission, okay, minimum of two tourniquets, fellas. Three is fine if you want to carry three, but a minimum of two tourniquets.
Mm-hmm. So they're ready, obviously.
They've got them strapped on their shoulders and their legs, you know, just ready to pull out with a little red tab on them so you don't lose them.
We had to carry ones with us also. Mm-hmm.
Did it help with the finger?
I couldn't figure out how to use it.
It's easy to make light of this when we're all back here safe and sound in a radio studio, needless to say. One of the things I noted in the dispatches was the use of drones. That gets a lot of publicity here because of the destructive nature of these devices. But with your group, Jesse, used for a much different reason.
Yeah, they're surveillance drones, and they get them to fly out ahead of them to monitor the routes to see if there's disturbances in the soil, to see if there's people out on stopping in the middle of a road on a motorcycle and digging up and planting an IED. And so they can run them at night, in the daytime, when there's good weather, and they're used quite often. And one of them was piloted. He was a contractor from Kirkwood. We ran into there at the base. You know, St. Louis
Sundin, was that his name? Something like
Peter
Sundin.
Sunder.
Sunder, yeah.
He's standing out there with a red St. Louis Cardinals cap on. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. And any experience with this new type of warfare, JB?
I was somewhat surprised that we were allowed to get up close and personal with these planes and photograph them. And we got to stand behind him in the little control room and for a few minutes and watch and them pilot these things and see what they're seeing. And the technology is just amazing. And I couldn't photograph that part of it, but it was really something to see and how much more secure they feel when they've got those eyes in the sky.
It's kind of like playing video games for these guys, is it not, the way they operate with joysticks and all the rest of it?
It is very much so. Not only the drone pilots, but the guys in our Buffalo, the gunner, they still have the standard gunner type guy who has to climb up above and the vehicle and swivel around with his machine gun. But my guy was sitting right next to me, and he's got a TV screen in front of him and a joystick, and he's watching the countryside and swiveling this big gun around up above him, and it is very much like a video game.
I saw that once on the battleship Missouri on its last voyage, which I happened to be on, and you go up into the room where they handle all the guns and all the missiles on that ship, and it was like five guys playing Nintendo. They were just standing in front of a monitor with joysticks.
The funny thing is that these guys come back from these missions, and they go right to their room. They eat dinner, go right to their rooms, and play Call of Duty, yeah, to all evening long. they haven't gotten enough of the video game.
And as JB indicated, Jesse, the troops have to love these drones with the work that they can do and the mission that they can accomplish.
Any extra help they can get that'll reduce the risk whenever they go down that isolated dirt road. But what's amazing and what the Indiana Guard unit told me before we went was that, you know, we have all this multi-million-dollar vehicles and technology, but they're still killing us. And you hear it over and over again from Special Forces guys into the other guardsmen that were there before the Missourians. They kept saying about the insurgents, the fighters, that these people are not stupid. They're very good at what they do, and they do it with the bare minimum. These IEDs, I mean, they're made with, you know, fertilizer, explosives, yellow plastic jugs, and some wood and an extension cord.
A couple of plastic plates.
Yeah. And some kind of detonator. It's not a lot that's spent on these devices that are very effective.
And have been for a long, long time. I guess they've caused more damage to our people in Iraq and Afghanistan than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Our time is beginning to get somewhat away from us. Give me some sense of what we can read in the time ahead. I understand on Sunday you're going to have some special material. Give us a preview of what's coming.
Well, it's very newsy now that the drawdown is happening, that they need to close down or retrograde, as they say, a bunch of bases. We went along with them on a multi-day mission to close down a base that was out in the middle of nowhere, and it was on a route that they'd been on several times before and encountered IEDs in the past. So the story will show just kind of what has to take place to close just one of these 200 or so bases that need to close by the end of 2014. Didn't go as planned.
It didn't go as planned.
But it was a safe trip. It didn't go as planned.
And is that going to be the end of this particular series Sunday?
Yes.
Yeah. JB, in terms of your part of it, pictures, what do you want us to look for?
Well, we are going to have pictures and story in the main part of the paper, and the page we have on our website is going to stay there, and we can certainly add to it as time goes on. We can localize the story and do more stories about the men, especially when they come home. And I definitely plan to be there in Farmington when they come back.
You have a favorite picture?
No.
Okay. Well, you can see most of them. They're great men of them anyway. Once again, on our site, stlpublicradio.org, we have material posted. We also have a link to stltoday.com/Afghanistan, where this material is going to be presented. And, of course, look for the Post-Dispatch on Sunday when you'll see the final part of this current episode from Jesse Bogan and J.B. Forbes. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Glad to have you home safe and sound, except for that vicious finger wound, J.B., but I'm sure that's been taken care of.
Yeah,
thanks, guys, for being with us, and great job.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the preparation of 2012 income tax returns, so get your questions ready for CPA Lance Weiss. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.